It was a dreadful question. What had been the use of promising one another that they would not on any account set the knight free, if they were now to do so the first time he happened to call upon a name they really cared about? On the other hand, what had been the use of learning the signs if they weren't going to obey them? Yet could Aslan have really meant them to unbind anyone, even a lunatic, who asked it in his name? Could it be a mere accident? Or how, if the Queen of the Underworld knew all about the signs and had made the knight learn this name simply in order to entrap them? But then, supposing this was the real sign, they had muffed three already. They daren't muff the fourth.
"Oh, if only we knew," said Jill.
"I think we do know," said Puddleglum.
"Do you mean you think everything will come right if we do untie him?" said Scrub.
"I don't know about that," said Puddleglum. "See, Aslan didn't tell Poll what would happen. He only told her what to do. That fellow would be the death of us once he's up, I shouldn't wonder. But that doesn't let us off following the sign."
They all stood looking at one another with bright eyes. It was a sickening moment. "All right," said Jill suddenly. "Let's get it over. Goodbye, everyone." They all shook hands. The knight was screaming by now. There was foam on his cheeks.
"Come on, Scrub," said Puddleglum. He and Scrub drew their swords and went over to the captive.
"In the name of Aslan," they said, and began methodically cutting the cords. The instant the prisoner was free, he crossed the room in a single bound, seized his sword, which had been taken from him and laid on the table, and drew it. "You first," he cried, and fell upon the silver chair. That must have been a good sword. The silver gave way before its edge like string, and in a moment a few twisted fragments, shining on the floor, were all that was left. But as the chair broke, there came from it a bright flash, a sound like small thunder, and for one moment a loathsome smell. "Lie there, vile engine of sorcery," he said, "lest your mistress should ever use you for another victim." Then he turned and surveyed his rescuers, and the something wrong, whatever it was, had vanished from his face.
"What?" he cried, turning to Puddleglum. "Do I see before me a Marshwiggle? A real, live, honest Narnian Marshwiggle?"
"Oh, so you have heard of Narnia, after all," said Jill.
"Had I forgotten it when I was under the spell?" asked the knight. "Well, that and all other bedevilments are now over. You may well believe that I know Narnia, for I am Rillian, Prince of Narnia, and Caspian the Great King is my father."
"Your Royal Highness," said Puddleglum, sinking on one knee,
and the children did the same,
"we have come hither for no other end than to seek you."
"And who are you, my other deliverers?" said the prince to Scrub and Jill.
"We were sent by Aslan himself from beyond the world's end to seek your highness," said Scrub. "I am Eustace, who sailed with him to the island of Romandu."
"I owe all three of you a greater debt than I can ever pay," said Prince Rillian. "But my father, is he yet alive?"
"He sailed east again before we left Narnia, my lord," said Puddleglum. "But your highness must consider that the king is very old. It is 10 to 1 his majesty must die on the voyage."
"He is old, you say? How long then have I been in the power of the witch?"
"Well, it is more than 10 years since your highness was lost in the woods at the north side of Narnia."
10 years, said the prince, drawing his hand across his face as if to rub away the past. "Yes, I believe you. For now that I am myself, I can remember that enchanted life. But while I was enchanted, I could not remember my true self. And now, fair friends—" "But wait, I hear their feet. Does it not sicken a man, that padding, woolly tread, on the stairs? Lock the door, boy. Or stay, I have a better thought than that. I will fool these earthmen, if Aslan gives me the wit. Take your cue from me."
He walked resolutely to the door and flung it wide open.
Chapter 12. The Queen of Underland. Two Earthmen entered, but instead of advancing into the room, they placed themselves one on each side of the door and bowed deeply. They were followed immediately by the last person whom anyone had expected or wished to see, the Lady of the Green Kirtle, the Queen of Underland. She stood dead still in the doorway, and they could see her eyes moving as she took in the whole situation, the three strangers, the silver chair destroyed, and the prince free with his sword in his hand. She turned very white. But Jill thought it was the sort of whiteness that comes over some people's faces not when they are frightened, but when they are angry. For a moment, the witch fixed her eyes on the prince, and there was murder in them. Then she seemed to change her mind. "Leave us," she said to the two earthmen, "and let none disturb us till I call on pain of death." The gnomes padded away obediently, and the witch queen shut and locked the door.
"How now, my lord prince," she said. "Has your nightly fit not yet come upon you? Or is it over so soon? Why stand you here unbound? Who are these aliens? And is it they who have destroyed the chair which was your only safety?"
Prince Rillian shivered as she spoke to him, and no wonder. It is not easy to throw off in half an hour an enchantment which has made one a slave for 10 years. Then, speaking with a great effort, he said, "Madam, there will be no more need of that chair. And you, who have told me 100 times how deeply you pitied me for the sorceries by which I was bound, will doubtless hear with joy that they are now ended for ever. There was, it seems, some small error in your ladyship's way of treating them. These, my true friends, have delivered me. I am now in my right mind, and there are 2 things I will say to you. First, as for your ladyship's design of putting me at the head of an army of earthmen, so that I may break out into the overworld and there, by main force, make myself king over some nation that never did me wrong, murdering their natural lords and holding their throne as a bloody and foreign tyrant, now that I know myself, I do utterly abhor and renounce it as plain villainy. And second, I am the king's son of Narnia, Rillian, the only child of Caspian, 10th of that name, whom some call Caspian the Seafarer. Therefore, madam, it is my purpose, as it is also my duty, to depart suddenly from your highness's court into my own country. Please it you to grant me and my friends safe conduct and a guide through your dark realm." Now the witch said nothing at all, but moved gently across the room, always keeping her face and eyes very steadily towards the prince. When she had come to a little ark set in the wall not far from the fireplace, she opened it, and took out first a handful of a green powder. This she threw on the fire. It did not blaze much, but a very sweet and drowsy smell came from it. And all through the conversation which followed, that smell grew stronger and filled the room and made it harder to think. Secondly, she took out a musical instrument, rather like a mandolin. She began to play it with her fingers, a steady, monotonous thrumming that you didn't notice after a few minutes. But the less you noticed it, the more it got into your brain and your blood. This also made it hard to think. After she had thrummed for a time, and the sweet smell was now strong, she began speaking in a sweet, quiet voice.
"Narnia," she said, "Narnia. I have often heard your lordship utter that name in your ravings. Dear prince, you are very sick. There is no land called Narnia."
"There is, though, madam," said Puddleglum. "You see, I happen to have lived there all my life."
"Indeed," said the witch. "Tell me, I pray you, where that country is."
"Up there," said Puddleglum stoutly, pointing overhead. I don't know exactly where.
How? Said the Queen, with a kind, soft, musical laugh. Is there a country up among the stones and mortar of the roof?
No, said Puddleglum, struggling a little to get his breath. It's in the overworld.
And what, or where, pray, is this, how do you call it, overworld?
Oh, don't be so silly, said Scrub, who was fighting hard against the enchantment of the sweet smell and the thrumming.
As if you didn't know, it's up above, up where you can see the sky and the sun and the stars. Why, you've been there yourself, we met you there.
I cry you mercy, little brother, laughed the witch. You couldn't have heard a lovelier laugh.
I have no memory of that meeting. But we often meet our friends in strange places when we dream. And unless all dreamed alike, you must not ask them to remember it.
Madam, said the prince sternly, I have already told your grace that I am the king's son of Narnia.
And shalt be, dear friend, said the witch in a soothing voice, as if she were humouring a child, shalt be king of many imagined lands in thy fancies.
We've been there too, snapped Jill.
She was very angry because she could feel enchantment getting hold of her every moment, but of course the very fact that she could still feel it showed that it had not yet fully worked.
And thou art queen of Narnia too, I doubt not, pretty one, said the witch in the same coaxing, half-mocking tone.
I'm nothing of the sort, said Jill, stamping her foot. We come from another world.
Why, this is a prettier game than the other, said the witch. Tell us, little maid, where is this other world? What ships and chariots go between it and ours?
Of course, a lot of things darted into Jill's head at once. Experiment House, Adler Pennyfather, her own home, radio sets, cinemas, cars, aeroplanes, ration books, queues. But they seemed dim and far away.
Thrum, 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 went the strings of the witch's instrument.
Jill couldn't remember the names of the things in our world, and this time it didn't come into her head that she was being enchanted, for now the magic was in its full strength. And of course, the more enchanted you get, the more certain you feel that you are not enchanted at all. She found herself saying, and at the moment it was a relief to say,
No, I suppose that other world must be all a dream. Yes, it is all a dream, said the witch, always thrumming. Yes, all a dream, said Jill. There never was such a world, said the witch. No, said Jill and Scrub. Never was such a world. There never was any world but mine, said the witch. There never was any world but yours, said they.
Puddleglum was still fighting hard. I don't know rightly what you all mean by a world, he said, talking like a man who hasn't enough air. But you can play that fiddle till your fingers drop off, and still you won't make me forget Narnia, and the whole overworld, too. We'll never see it again, I shouldn't wonder. You may have blotted it out and turned it dark like this, for all I know. Nothing more likely, but I know I was there once. I've seen the sky full of stars. I've seen the sun coming up out of the sea of a morning and sinking behind the mountains at night. And I've seen him up in the midday sky when I couldn't look at him for brightness.
Puddleglum's words had a very rousing effect. The other three all breathed again and looked at one another like people newly awaked.
Why, there it is, cried the prince. Of course, the blessing of Aslan upon this honest marshwiggle. We have all been dreaming these last few minutes. How could we have forgotten it? Of course, we've all seen the sun.
By Jove, so we have, said Scrub.
Good for you, Puddleglum. You're the only one of us with any sense, I do believe.
Then came the witch's voice, cooing softly, like the voice of a wood-pigeon, from the high elms in an old garden at 3 o'clock in the middle of a sleepy summer afternoon, and it said,
What is this sun that you all speak of? Do you mean anything by the word?
Yes, we jolly well do, said Scrub.
Can you tell me what it's like? Asked the witch. Thrum, 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 went the strings.
Please it, your grace, said the prince very coldly and politely. You see that lamp? It is round and yellow, and gives light to the whole room, and hangeth moreover from the roof. Now that thing which we call the sun is like the lamp, only far greater and brighter. It giveth light to the whole overworld, and hangeth in the sky.
Hangeth from what, my lord? Asked the witch, and then, while they were all still thinking how to answer her, she added with another of her soft, silver laughs, You see, when you try to think out clearly what this sun must be, you cannot tell me. You can only tell me it is like the lamp. Your sun is a dream, and there is nothing in that dream that was not copied from the lamp. The lamp is the real thing. The sun is but a tale, a children's story. Yes, I see now, said Jill in a heavy, hopeless tone. It must be so.
And while she said this, it seemed to her to be very good sense. Slowly and gravely the witch repeated, There is no sun. And they all said nothing. She repeated, in a softer and deeper voice,
There is no sun.
After a pause, and after a struggle in their minds, all four of them said together, You are right, there is no sun. It was such a relief to give in and say it.
There never was a sun, said the witch. No, there never was a sun, said the prince and the marshwiggle and the children.
For the last few minutes, Jill had been feeling that there was something she must remember at all costs. And now she did. But it was dreadfully hard to say it. She felt as if huge weights were laid on her lips. At last, with an effort that seemed to take all the good out of her, she said,
There's Aslan.
Aslan, said the witch, quickening ever so slightly the pace of her thrumming. What a pretty name. What does it mean?
He's the great lion who called us out of our own world, said Scrub, and sent us into this to find Prince Rillian.
What is a lion? Asked the witch.
Oh, hang it all, said Scrub. Don't you know? How can we describe it to her? Have you ever seen a cat?
Surely, said the queen. I love cats.
Well, a lion is a little bit, well, only a little bit, mind you, like a huge cat with a mane. At least it's not like a horse's mane, you know. It's more like a judge's wig, and it's yellow and terrifically strong.
The witch shook her head.
I see, she said, that we should do no better with your lion, as you call it, than we did with your son. You have seen lamps, and so you imagined a bigger and better lamp and called it the sun. You've seen cats, and now you want a bigger and better cat, and it's to be called a lion. Well, 'tis a pretty make-believe, though to say truth, it would suit you all better if you were younger. And look how you can put nothing into your make-believe without copying it from the real world of mine, which is the only world. But even you children are too old for such play. As for you, my lord prince, that art a man full grown, fire upon you. Are you not ashamed of such toys? Come, all of you, put away these childish tricks. I have work for you all in the real world. There is no Narnia, no overworld, no sky, no sun, no Aslan, and now to bed, all. And let us begin a wiser life tomorrow. But first, to bed, to sleep. Deep sleep. Soft pillows. Sleep. Without foolish dreams.
The prince and the two children were standing with their heads hung down, their cheeks flushed, their eyes half closed. The strength all gone from them, the enchantment almost complete. But Puddleglum,
desperately gathering all his strength, walked over to the fire. Then he did a very brave thing. He knew it wouldn't hurt him quite as much as it would hurt a human, for his feet, which were bare, were webbed and hard and cold-blooded like a duck's. But he knew it would hurt him badly enough, and so it did. With his bare foot he stamped on the fire, grinding a large part of it into ashes on the flat hearth. And three things happened at once. First, the sweet, heavy smell grew very much less, for though the whole fire had not been put out, a good part of it had, and what remained smelled very largely of burnt marshwiggle, which is not at all an enchanting smell. This instantly made everyone's brain far clearer. The prince and the children held up their heads again and opened their eyes. Secondly, the witch, in a loud, terrible voice, utterly different from all the sweet tones she'd been using up till now, called out, "What are you doing? Dare to touch my fire again, mud filth, and I'll turn the blood to fire inside your veins." Thirdly, the pain itself made Puddleglum's head for a moment perfectly clear, and he knew exactly what he really thought. There is nothing like a good shock of pain for dissolving certain kinds of magic. "One word, ma'am," he said, coming back from the fire, limping because of the pain. "One word. All you've been saying is quite right, I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who always like to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said, but there's one thing more to be said, even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that, in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So thanking you kindly for your supper, if these two gentlemen and the young lady are ready, we're leaving your court at once and setting out into the dark to spend our lives looking for the overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think, but that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say." "Oh, hooray, good old Puddleglum," cried Scrub and Jill. But the prince shouted suddenly, "Where? Look to the witch." When they did look, their hair nearly stood on end. The instrument dropped from her hands. Her arms appeared to be fastened to her sides. Her legs were intertwined with each other, and her feet had disappeared. The long green train of her skirt thickened and grew solid, and seemed to be all one piece with the writhing green pillar of her interlocked legs. And that writhing green pillar was curving and swaying as if it had no joints, or else were all joints. Her head was thrown far back, and while her nose grew longer and longer, every other part of her face seemed to disappear, except her eyes. Huge, flaming eyes they were now, without brows or lashes. All this takes time to write down. It happened so quickly that there was only just time to see it. Long before there was time to do anything, the change was complete, and the great serpent, which the witch had become, green as poison, thick as Jill's waist, had flung two or three coils of its loathsome body round the prince's legs. Quick as lightning, another great loop darted round, intending to pinion his sword arm to his side, but the prince was just in time. He raised his arms and got them clear. The living knot closed only round his chest, ready to crack his ribs like firewood when it drew tight. The prince caught the creature's neck in his left hand, trying to squeeze it till it choked. This held its face, if you could call it a face, about 5 inches from his own. The forked tongue flickered horribly in and out, but could not reach him. With his right hand, he drew back his sword for the strongest blow he could give. Meanwhile, Scrub and Puddleglum had drawn their weapons and rushed to his aid. All three blows fell at once. Scrub's, which did not even pierce the scales and did no good, on the body of the snake below the prince's hand, but the prince's own blow and Puddleglum's both on its neck. Even that did not quite kill it, though it began to loosen its hold on Rillian's legs and chest. With repeated blows, they hacked off its head. The horrible thing went on coiling and moving like a bit of wire long after it had died. And the floor, as you may imagine, was a nasty mess. The prince, when he had breath, said, "Gentlemen, I thank you." Then the three conquerors stood staring at one another and panting without another word for a long time. Jill had very wisely sat down and was keeping quiet. She was saying to herself, "I do hope I don't faint, or blub, or do anything idiotic." "My royal mother is avenged," said Rillian presently. "This is undoubtedly the same worm that I pursued in vain by the fountain in the forest of Narnia so many years ago. All these years I have been the slave of my mother's slayer. Yet I am glad, gentlemen, that the foul witch took to her serpent form at the last. It would not have suited well either my heart or with my honour to have slain a woman. But look to the lady," he meant Jill. "I'm all right, thanks," said she. "Damsel," said the prince, bowing to her, "you are of a high courage, and therefore, I doubt not, you come of a noble blood in your own world. But come, friends, here is some wine left. Let us refresh ourselves and each pledge his fellows. After that, to our plans."
"A jolly good idea, sir," said Scrub.
Chapter 13. Underland Without the Queen. All felt that they had earned what Scrub called a breather. The witch had locked the door and told the earthmen not to disturb her, so there was no danger of interruption for the present. Their first business was, of course, Puddleglum's burnt foot. A couple of clean shirts from the prince's bedroom, torn into strips, and well greased on the inside with butter and salad oil off the supper table, made a fairly good dressing. When this had been applied, they all sat down and had a little refreshment, and discussed plans for escaping from the underworld. Rillian explained that there were quite a lot of outlets by which one could get to the surface. He'd been taken out through most of them at one time or another, but he had never gone out alone, only with the witch, and he had always reached these outlets by going in a ship across the sunless sea. What the earthmen would say if he went down to the harbour without the witch and with four strangers and simply ordered a ship, no one could guess, but most likely they would ask awkward questions. On the other hand, the new outlet, the one for the invasion of Overworld, was on this side of the sea and only a few miles away. The prince knew that it was nearly finished. Only a few feet of earth divided the diggings from the outer air. It was even possible that it had now been quite finished. Perhaps the witch had come back to tell him this and to start the attack. Even if it was not, they could probably dig themselves out by that route in a few hours, if they could only get there without being stopped, and if only they found the diggings unguarded. But those were the difficulties.
"If you ask me," began Puddleglum when Scrub interrupted.
"I say," he asked, "what's that noise?" "I've been wondering that for some time," said Jill.
They had all, in fact, been hearing the noise, but it had begun and increased so gradually that they did not know when they had first noticed it. For a time, it had been only a vague disquiet, like gentle winds or traffic very far away. Then it swelled to a murmur like the sea. Then came rumblings and rushings. Now there seemed to be voices as well, and also a steady roaring that was not voices.
"By the lion," said Prince Rillian, "it seems this silent land has found a tongue at last."
He rose, walked to the window, and drew aside the curtains. The others crowded round him to look out. The very first thing they noticed was a great red glow. Its reflection made a red patch on the roof of the underworld thousands of feet above them, so that they could see a rocky ceiling which had perhaps been hidden in darkness ever since the world was made. The glow itself came from the far side of the city, so that many buildings, grim and great, stood up blackly against it. But it also cast its light down many streets that ran from it towards the castle, and in those streets something very strange was going on. The closely packed, silent crowds of Earthmen had vanished. Instead, there were figures darting about by ones or twos or threes. They behaved like people who do not want to be seen, lurking in shadow behind buttresses or in doorways, and then moving quickly across the open into fresh places of hiding. But the strangest thing of all, to anyone who knew the gnomes, was the noise. Shouts and cries came from all directions, but from the harbour there came a low, rumbling roar which grew steadily louder and was already shaking the whole city. "What's happened to the Earthmen?" said Scrub. "Is it them shouting?" "'Tis hardly possible," said the prince. "I never heard one of the rascals so much as speak with a loud voice in all the weary years of my bondage. Some new devilry, I don't doubt."
"And what is that red light over there?" asked Jill. "Is something on fire?"
"If you ask me," said Puddleglum, "I should say that was the central fires of the earth breaking out to make a new volcano. We'll be in the middle of it, I shouldn't wonder."
"Look at that ship," said Scrub. "Why is it coming on so quickly? No one's rowing it."
"Look, look," said the prince. "The ship is already far this side of the harbour. It's in the street. Look, all the ships are driving into the city. By my head, the sea's rising. The flood is upon us. Aslan be praised. This castle stands on high ground, but the water comes on grimly fast."
"What can be happening?" cried Jill. "Fire and water and all those people dodging about the streets."
"I'll tell you what it is," said Puddleglum. "That witch has laid a train of magic spells so that whenever she was killed, at that same moment her whole kingdom would fall to pieces. She's the sort that wouldn't so much mind dying herself if she knew that the chap who killed her was going to be burned or buried or drowned 5 minutes later."
"Hast hit it, friend Wiggle," said the prince. "When our swords hacked off the witch's head, that stroke ended all her magic works, and now the deep lands are falling to pieces. We are looking on the end of the underworld."
"That's it, sir," said Puddleglum, "unless it should happen to be the end of the whole world."
"But are we just going to stay here and wait?" gasped Jill.
"Not by my counsel," said the prince. "I would save my horse Coldblack and the witcher's Snowflake, a noble beast and worthy of a better mistress, which are both stabled in the courtyard. After that, let us make shift to get out to high ground, and pray that we shall find an outlet. The horses can carry two each at need, and if we put them to it, they may outstrip the flood."
"Will your highness not put on armour?" asked Puddleglum. "I don't like the look of those."
And he pointed down to the street. Everyone looked down. Dozens of creatures, and now that they were close they obviously were Earthmen, were coming up from the direction of the harbour. But they were not moving like an aimless crowd. They behaved like modern soldiers in an attack, making rushes and taking cover, anxious not to be seen from the castle windows.
"I dare not see the inside of that armour again," said the prince. "I rode in it as in a movable dungeon, and it stinks of magic and slavery. But I will take the shield."
He left the room and returned with a strange light in his eyes a moment later.
"Look, friends," he said, holding out the shield towards them. "An hour ago it was black and without device, and now this." The shield had turned brighter silver, and on it, redder than blood or cherries, was the figure of the lion.
"Doubtless," said the prince, "this signifies that Aslan will be our good lord, whether he means us to live or die, and all's won for that. Now, by my counsel, we shall all kneel and kiss his likeness,
and then all shake hands, one with another, as true friends that may shortly be parted. And then let us descend into the city and take the adventure that is sent us. And they all did as the prince had said. But when Scrub shook hands with Jill, he said, "So long, Jill. Sorry I've been a funk and so ratty. Hope you get safe home." And Jill said, "So long, Eustace, and I'm sorry I've been such a pig." And this was the first time they'd ever used Christian names, because one didn't do it at school. The prince unlocked the door, and they all went down the stairs, three of them with drawn swords, and Jill with drawn knife. The attendants had vanished, and the great room at the foot of the prince's stairs was empty. The grey, doleful lamps were still burning, and by their light they had no difficulty in passing gallery after gallery and descending stairway after stairway. The noises from outside the castle were not so easily heard here as they had been in the room above. Inside the house all was still as death, and deserted. It was as they turned a corner into the great hall on the ground floor that they met their first Earthman. A fat, whitish creature, with a very pig-like face, who was gobbling up all the remains of food on the tables. It squealed, the squeal also was very like a pig's, and darted under a bench, whisking its long tail out of Puddleglum's reach in the nick of time. Then it rushed away through the far door too quickly to be followed. From the hall they came out into the courtyard. Jill, who went to a riding school in the holidays, had just noticed the smell of a stable, a very nice, honest, homely smell it is to meet in a place like Underland, when Eustace said, "Great Scott, look at that!" A magnificent rocket had risen from somewhere beyond the castle walls and broken into green stars. "Fireworks," said Jill in a puzzled voice. "Yes," said Eustace. "But you can't imagine those Earth people letting them off for fun. It must be a signal."
"It means no good to us, I'll be bound," said Puddleglum.
"Friends," said the prince, "when once a man is launched on such an adventure as this, he must bid farewell to hopes and fears. Otherwise death or deliverance will both come too late to save his honour and his reason."
"Oh, my beauties!"
He was now opening the stable door.
"Hey, cousin, steady, Coal Black. Softly now, Snowflake. You are not forgotten."
The horses were both frightened by the strange lights and the noises. Jill, who had been so cowardly about going through a black hole between one cave and another, went in without fear between the stamping and snorting beasts, and she and the prince had them saddled and bridled in a few minutes. Very fine they looked as they came out into the courtyard, tossing their heads. Jill mounted Snowflake, and Puddleglum got up behind her. Eustace got up behind the prince on Coal Black. Then, with a great echo of hooves, they rode out of the main gateway into the street.
"Not much danger of being burnt, that's the bright side of it," observed Puddleglum, pointing to their right.
There, hardly 100 yards away, lapping against the walls of the houses, was water.
"Courage," said the prince. "The road there goes down steeply. That water has climbed only half up the greatest hill in the city. It might come so near in the first half hour and come no nearer in the next two. My fear is more of that."
And he pointed with his sword to a great tall Earthman with boar's tusks, followed by 6 others of assorted shapes and sizes, who had just dashed out of a side street and stepped into the shadow of the houses where no one could see them. The prince led them, aiming always in the direction of the glowing red light, but a little to the left of it. His plan was to get round the fire, if it was a fire, onto high ground, in hope that they might find their way to the new diggings. Unlike the other three, he seemed to be almost enjoying himself. He whistled as he rode, and sang snatches of an old song about Corin Thunderfist of Arkenland. The truth is, he was so glad at being free from his long enchantment that all dangers seemed a game in comparison. But the rest found it an eerie journey. Behind them was the sound of clashing and entangled ships and the rumble of collapsing buildings. Overhead was the great patch of lurid light on the roof of the underworld. Ahead was the mysterious glow, which did not seem to grow any bigger. From the same direction came a continual hubbub of shouts, screams, catcalls, laughter, squeals and bellowings, and fireworks of all sorts rose in the dark air. No one could guess what they meant. Nearer to them, the city was partly lit up by the red glow and partly by the very different light of the dreary gnome lamps. But there were many places where neither of these lights fell, and those places were jet black. And, in and out of those places, the shapes of Earthmen were darting and slipping all the time, always with their eyes fixed on the travellers, always trying to keep out of sight themselves. There were big faces and little faces, huge eyes like fishes' eyes, and little eyes like bears. There were feathers and bristles, horns and tusks, noses like whipcord, and chins so long they looked like beards. Every now and then a group of them would get too big or come too near, then the prince would brandish his sword and make a show of charging them. And the creatures, with all manner of hootings, squeakings, and cluckings, would dive away into the darkness. But when they had climbed many steep streets and were far away from the flood, and almost out of the town on the inland side, it began to be more serious. They were now close to the red glow, and nearly on a level with it, though they still could not see what it really was. But by its light, they could see their enemies more clearly. Hundreds, perhaps a few thousands of gnomes were all moving towards it, but they were doing so in short rushes, and whenever they stopped, they turned and faced the travellers.
"If Your Highness asked me," said Puddleglum, "I'd say those fellows were meaning to cut us off in front."
"That was my thought too, Puddleglum," said the prince, "and we can never fight our way through so many. Hark you, let us ride forth close by the edge of yonder house, and even as we reach it, do you slip off into its shadow. The lady and I will go forward a few paces. Some of these devils will follow us, I doubt not. They are thick behind us. Do you, who have long arms, take one alive, if you may, as it passes your ambush. We may get a true tale of it, or learn what is their quarrel against us."
"But won't the others all come rushing at us to rescue the one we catch?" said Jill, in a voice not so steady as she tried to make it.
"Then, madam," said the prince, "you shall see us die fighting around you, and you must commend yourself to the lion. Now, good Puddleglum."
The marsh wiggle slipped off into the shadow as quickly as a cat. The others, for a sickening minute or so, went forward at a walk. Then suddenly from behind them there broke out a series of blood-curdling screams, mixed with the familiar voice of Puddleglum saying,
"Now then, don't cry out before you're hurt, or you will be hurt, see? Anyone would think it was a pig being killed."
"That was good hunting," exclaimed the prince, immediately turning coal-black and coming back to the corner of the house.
"Eustace," he said, "of your courtesy take coal-black's head."
Then he dismounted, and all three gazed in silence while Puddleglum pulled his catch out into the light. It was a most miserable little gnome, only about 3 feet long. It had a sort of ridge, like a cock's comb, only hard, on the top of its head, little pink eyes, and a mouth and chin so large and round that its face looked like that of a pygmy hippopotamus. If they had not been in such a tight place, they would have burst into laughter at the sight of it.
"Now, Earthman," said the prince, standing over it and holding his sword point very near the prisoner's neck, "speak up, like an honest gnome, and you shall go free. Play the knave with us, and you are but a dead Earthman. Good Puddleglum, how can it speak while you hold its mouth tight shut?"
"No, and it can't bite either," said Puddleglum. "If I had the silly soft hands that you humans have, saving your highness's reverence, I'd have been all over blood by now. Yet even a marshwiggle gets tired of being chewed."
"Sirrah," said the prince to the gnome, "one bite, and you die.
Let its mouth open, Puddleglum."
"Whee!"
squealed the earthman.
"Let me go! Let me go! It isn't me, I didn't do it."
"Didn't do what?" asked Puddleglum.
"Whatever your honours say I did do.
answered the creature. "Tell me your name," said the prince, "and what you earthmen are all about today."
"Oh, please, Your Honor, please, kind gentlemen," whimpered the gnome. "Promise you will not tell the Queen's Grace anything I say."
"The Queen's Grace, as you call her," said the prince sternly, "is dead. I killed her myself."
"What?"
cried the gnome, opening its ridiculous mouth wider and wider in astonishment.
"Dead? The witch? Dead? And by Your Honor's hand?"
It gave a huge sigh of relief and added,
"Why, then, Your Honor is a friend."
The prince withdrew his sword an inch or so. Puddleglum let the creature sit up. It looked round on the four travellers with its twinkling red eyes, chuckled once or twice, and began. Chapter 14. The Bottom of the World.
"My name is Golg," said the gnome, "and I'll tell Your Honours all I know. About an hour ago we were all going about our work, her work, I should say, sad and silent, same as we've done any other day for years and years. Then there came a great crash and bang. As soon as they heard it, everyone says to himself, 'I haven't had a song or a dance or let off a squib for a long time. Why's that?' And everyone thinks to himself, 'Why, I must have been enchanted.' And then everyone says to himself, 'I'm blessed if I know why I'm carrying this load, and I'm not going to carry it any further. That's that.' And down we all throw our sacks and bundles and tools. Then everyone turns and sees the great red glow over yonder. And everyone says to himself, 'What's that?' And everyone answers himself and says, 'There's a crack or chasm split open, and a nice warm glow coming up through it from the really deep land 1,000 fathoms under us.'"
"Great Scott!" exclaimed Eustace. "Are there other lands still lower down?"
"Oh, yes, Your Honour," said Golg. "Lovely places, what we call the land of Bism. This country where we are now, the witch's country, is what we call the shallow lands. It's a good deal too near the surface to suit us. You might almost as well be living outside on the surface itself. You see, we're all poor gnomes from Bism, whom the witch has called up here by magic to work for her. But we'd forgotten all about it till that crash came and the spell broke. We didn't know who we were, or where we belonged. We couldn't do anything or think anything except what she put into our heads, and it was glam and gloomy things she put there all those years. I've nearly forgotten how to make a joke or dance a jig. But the moment the bang came and the chasm opened and the sea began rising, it all came back. And, of course, we all set off as quick as we could to get down the crack and home to our own place. And you can see them over there all letting off rockets and standing on their heads for joy. And I'll be very obliged, Your Honours, if you'll soon let me go and join in."
"I think this is simply splendid," said Jill. "I'm so glad we freed the gnomes as well as ourselves when we cut off the witch's head. And I'm so glad they aren't really horrid and gloomy, any more than the prince really was, well, what he seemed like."
"That's all very well, Poll," said Puddleglum cautiously. "But those gnomes didn't look to me like chaps who were just running away. They looked more like military formations, if you ask me. Do you look me in the face, Mr. Golg, and tell me you weren't preparing for battle?"
"Of course we were, Your Honour," said Golg. "You see, we didn't know the witch was dead. We thought she'd be watching from the castle. We were trying to slip away without being seen. And then, when you four came out with swords and horses, of course everyone says to himself, 'Here it comes,' not knowing that His Honour wasn't on the witch's side. And we were determined to fight like anything rather than give up the hope of going back to Bism."
"I'll be sworn 'tis an honest gnome," said the prince. "Let go of it, friend Puddleglum. As for me, good Golg, I have been enchanted like you and your fellows, and have but newly remembered myself. And now one question more. Do you know the way to those new diggings by which the sorceress meant to lead out an army against Overland?"
squeaked Golg.
"Yes, I know that terrible road. I will show you where it begins, but it is no manner of use your honour asking me to go with you on it. I'll die, rather."
"Why?" asked Eustace anxiously. "What's so dreadful about it?"
"Too near the top, the outside," said Golg, shuddering. "That was the worst thing the witch did to us. We were going to be led out into the open, onto the outside of the world. They say there's no roof at all there, only a horrible great emptiness called the sky. And the diggings have gone so far that a few strokes of the pick would bring you out to it. I wouldn't dare go near them."
"Hooray! Now you're talking," cried Eustace. And Jill said, "But it's not horrid at all up there. We like it. We live there."
"I know you overlanders live there," said Golg, "but I thought it was because you couldn't find your way down inside. You can't really like it, crawling about like flies on the top of the world."
"What about showing us the road at once?" said Puddleglum. "In a good hour," cried the prince. The whole party set out. The prince remounted his charger. Puddleglum climbed up behind Jill, and Golg led the way. As he went, he kept shouting out the good news that the witch was dead, and that the four overlanders were not dangerous. And those who heard him shouted it on to others, so that in a few minutes the whole of Underland was ringing with shouts and cheers, and gnomes by hundreds and thousands leaping, turning cartwheels, standing on their heads, playing leapfrog, and letting off huge crackers came pressing round Coalblack and Snowflake, and the prince had to tell the story of his own enchantment and deliverance at least 10 times. In this way, they came to the edge of the chasm. It was about 1,000 feet long and perhaps 200 wide. They dismounted from their horses and came to the edge and looked down into it. A strong heat smote up into their faces, mixed with a smell which was quite unlike any they had ever smelled. It was rich, sharp, exciting, and made you sneeze. The depth of the chasm was so bright that at first it dazzled their eyes and they could see nothing. When they got used to it, they thought they could make out a river of fire, and on the banks of that river what seemed to be fields and groves of an unbearable hot brilliance, though they were dim compared with the river. There were blues, reds, greens, and whites all jumbled together. A very good stained-glass window with the tropical sun staring straight through it at midday might have something of the same effect. Down the rugged sides of the chasm, looking black like flies against all that fiery light, hundreds of earthmen were climbing.
"Your honours," said Golg, and when they turned to look at him they could see nothing but blackness for a few minutes, their eyes were so dazzled. "Your honours, why don't you come down to Beacham? You'd be happier there than in that cold, unprotected, naked country out on top. Or at least come down for a short visit."
Jill took it for granted that none of the others would listen to such an idea for a moment. To her horror, she heard the prince saying, "Truly, friend Golg, I have half a mind to come down with you, for this is a marvellous adventure, and it may be no mortal man has ever looked into Bizen before, or will ever have the chance again. And I know not how, as the years pass, I shall bear to remember that it was once in my power to have probed the uttermost pit of earth, and that I forbore. But could a man live there? You do not swim in the Fire River itself."
"Oh, no, Your Honour, not we. It's only salamanders live in the fire itself."
"What kind of beast is your salamander?" asked the prince.
"It's hard to tell their kind.